Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm still interested in mythology, photography, riding to hounds, in fact, in everything. But at 19, my thoughts turned to flying, and I decided to do it seriously. I was convinced that aviation was a profession with a future and determined to earn my living and make my career a paying proposition.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. Pauline Gower is best remembered today as the intrepid commander of the women's section of the Air Transport Auxiliary during the Second World War. But there is much more to Gower than those fateful 6 years. Overcoming childhood illness, Gower would go on to an incredible aviation career, publish 2 volumes of poetry, and capped it all with the foundation of the women's section of the ATA, ensuring her pilots received equal pay for equal work in the dangerous delivery of high-performance aircraft. Under her leadership, women flew every type of RAF aircraft, ensuring a steady supply of new and replacement aircraft to frontline and training units. Alison Hill is a poet and author of the new biography of Pauline Gower, which is a heartfelt look at this remarkable woman and the remarkable women that she surrounded herself with. Our conversation is going to focus on Pauline's life before the ATA, but when I'm speaking with a poet, about a poet, I had to ask Alison to start with, what drew her to Pauline Gower? Was it the poet or the pilot?
I think it was very much both. And a little story of how I came across Pauline Gower. Of all places, in Hampton Court Emporium, which is a grand title for a very dusty, overflowing shop full of vintage clothes, assorted glassware, ornaments from every decade, and on one of my visits, a pristine copy of Spitfire Women by Gerald Whittle in the very small section of secondhand books. And I thought, wow, I mean, my eye was drawn to the cover, first of all, the pilots on the front. And I didn't really know that women had flown Spitfires in the Second World War, let alone, as I found out, tiger moths, mosquitoes, hurricanes, Wellingtons, and many more types. So I bought the book, of course, you know, I wasn't going to leave the shop without it. And I soon discovered a wealth of stories.
You've got to throw typhoons and tempests into your list because they're my favourites.
Yeah, everything. So I bought the book and I was really lucky, and I sort of lucky enough to meet some of the women in the pages. So that was fascinating. I just decided it was Giles Whittle's book is a really, really great overview of the story, of the pilots, of the women, of the time. And he's a journalist, so he writes in it in a very succinct way. But I just thought reading through, I thought there's so many stories here that need perhaps another way of reaching people. And so I decided to write a poetry collection, as you do, sort of, and try and put as many women in their stories into this poetry collection as I could. So that resulted in Sisters and Spitfires. And I was really pleased to find that some of the pilots, as well as, you know, flying these amazing array of planes throughout the war, actually wrote themselves as well. At least 3 or 4 of them wrote poetry, and Pauline was one of them. So I thought, there's a synergy here, really. And I was lucky enough to actually republish some of her poems in a book before this one called 50 Ways to Fly. So I feel like her work is reaching new audiences. I've read some of her poems in schools and next to Spitfires and Hurricanes. And I just feel like her words are sort of resonating down the decades and are reaching new audiences like that.
So. Because before I read your book, I had no idea about the poetry. I just knew Pauline Gower, head of Women's Section 88. That was dying tragically young, of course. But delving into that, there's just so many facets to her, which we're going to have a little chat about. But that was really, really interesting that this woman who's probably main legacy is that ATA element, that people don't see the artist beyond the leader, which tends to happen sometimes, really, with historical figures.
Really good way of putting it. She's really creative in lots of ways. I think writing was just one of the forms. But she composed some of her poems while waiting to take people up for flights. So, you know.
Well, we're going to get to that bit because we have to start at the beginning, because her life, just all the way through, is just utterly fascinating. But who were her people? Where was she from?
She was born in Tunbridge Wells. She was born on 22nd of July, 1910, at Sandown Court in Tunbridge Wells in Kent. She was the second daughter of parents Sir Robert and Lady Dorothy Gower. So clearly she was from a fairly wealthy middle-class background, but she was determined from the outset, when she'd left school, she was determined to make her way of earning her own living through the thing she loved best, which was flying. Which quite unusual then. She could have just sort of sat back on her wealth and decided she wasn't really going to do that, but that's what she did. And she followed her ambitions and made that happen. So her father, Sir Robert Gower, was quite a character. He was equally ambitious in the field of politics and had some strong causes to his name. He was known as the Dogs MP for his concern for animal welfare and was chair of the RSPCA for many years. He was also keen that both his daughters had a good education, which was fairly unusual for the time. We'll come on to that a little later. But his wife, Dorothy Gower, she was a very loyal wife and she undertook lots of engagements alongside him. She opened dog shows and other interesting engagements. But she seemed to enjoy this and they appear in lots of press photographs alongside each other. And later, some of that work would fall to Pauline.
I've just sort of Googled Robert Gower because I did this the other day. It's quite funny that the majority, it's father of Pauline and then a little bit about the animal activism and that's about it. But he was a very sort of, we call him a crusading MP nowadays, wouldn't he? He very much would pin his mast to various causes on where you mentioned animal welfare and things. The thing I found interesting as well was the work that the ladies of the family had to do. They were very much front and center in his activities as an MP. He was involving the whole family, wasn't he?
He was. He was also a real collector of scrapbooks. He bequeathed 50 scrapbooks, these are thick books, to Tunbridge Wells Library. So an excellent source of information and research. I visited them twice, and I think I went through most of them. And now they have some new, lovely new archive boxes that have been moved from library to library. Very much sort of pride of place in the library. But he collected everything in the press. Pauline, obviously, was a focal point. She was in the press a lot through all her aviation career. And then her writing as well appeared in the press. But he collated all these into scrapbooks. And I detail some of that in the book, 50 of them. And his older daughter, Dorothy, also called Dorothy, when she married, he kept the serviette from her wedding and it was folded into the book. So I took it out and read it and then I carefully folded it back along the folds he had used. So he wanted to preserve history as well, I think. And his daughter was the same. She also kept scrapbooks. So there's a family tradition, I think, of keeping memories.
It's the thing a proud dad would do, wasn't it? Keeping all the bits and pieces for his daughters. So what sort of child was Pauline? So she's growing up in quite an interesting house with sort of forthright views, left, right and centre. So what sort of girl was she?
I think she was a very forthright girl as well. She went to Beechwood Sacred Heart Convent School in Tunbridge Wells, just up the road, but she was a boarder. I think that was probably the tradition, really, which I think she enjoyed. She was there for a good 7-8 years. And many former pupils, I was lucky enough to read about what some of her sort of fellow peers had written about. And they all, I think she was on a bit of a pinnacle, really. She was called a glittering figure by one former school friend. And I just read a little bit about what one of them had said, actually. Successfully academically, musical, very good at games. She was popular with her schoolmates and the nuns, not just because of her talents and amusing ways, but because she was even-tempered. And this friend said, "I can't reflect her being unfair or unkind to a junior. She could always be relied on to organise treasure hunts in the school grounds, charades or surprise concerts, and her singing Lancashire songs, accompanying herself on the ukulele, in ribbons flying as she danced around, is still a jolly memory." She also, which I was really intrigued, she also climbed every tree in the grounds and climbed out to most of the dormitory windows. And I put that into a poem about Pauline. I went to visit the school a couple of times, and these dormitory windows, they're on, I think, the second floor. It's an old crumbling building, and I think most of the sort of window ledges were crumbling when I was there. So I imagine her sort of climbing along window ledges and climbing down and just reaching for the sky, but also there's a real sense of adventure up there, I think, in her.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. All those stories that you have from her school days, she seems like she was irrepressible. It's the word that just kept sort of popping to my head. She's always was trying to push things on. But it wasn't all happy times, was it? She got terribly ill.
She very nearly died at the age of 17. She had a very serious brush with death. She was in an out-of-school infirmary with an ongoing and prolonged ear infection, which turned out to be very severe and very nearly escalated to death. She was overnight in the hospital, and the nuns and the girls were lighting candles and praying for her. And there was a very strong fear that she was not going to make it through the night. But she did. And I think strength of character and strength of her will, I think by the second day she was up demanding chicken soup, or at least eating chicken soup. So she'd come through something very serious and very nearly died. And I think it slightly altered her perception. I think she thought now she was going to do as much as she could. That's sort of my feeling from what she then went on to do. And I think she thought, you know, she'd come through sort of a very serious night and operation, and she'd made it, and she was going to go for it. So
flying enters her life around about this time. So post stillness, isn't it? And what do you think drew her to that? Was it this desire of the brush from death to just literally grab the most exciting thing that she could? And that was,
I think it is. I'm going to read a couple of bits that sort of say in her own words why she chose flying. She could have chosen lots of different things. As she said, "I'm still interested in mythology, photography, riding to hounds, in fact, in everything. But at 19, my thoughts turned to flying, and I decided to do it seriously. I was convinced that aviation was a profession with a future, and determined to earn my living and make my career a paying proposition." So that was that determined streak in her, I think.
Yeah, it's that line there, the paying proposition. It wasn't just joining the flying set, which about this time was, yeah, one of the in things, wasn't it? The Brooklyn's crowd and all of them. But it was to make her own career out of it.
Very much so. I mean, really, her parents probably expected her to do a London season, which she did. And she said in her own words that she was bored to tears. I think she went to Paris briefly. She did the London season. Was probably expected to find a suitable husband and eventually settle down and provide some grandchildren. But she wanted to do more with that. She'd had that brush with death. And so she told her parents, and I imagine this, I think I wrote it in a poem, but I did read it in one of her own sort of pieces of writing, that she told them over the breakfast table she was going to learn to fly. And I imagine her father, or I think she's recounted that he just shook his newspaper and carried on reading. And her mother might have quietly put her teaspoon down, sort of waiting for the reaction. And I think her father said, "Well, I'm not going to pay for you to break your neck." He wasn't going to support her, and so she decided that she was going to fly. And she gave violin lessons. I mentioned she's very good at music, so she said she'd give violin lessons to unsuspecting pupils and earn money for flying lessons that way, which she did. So she paid for initial flying lessons.
So Stag Lane was the place to learn to fly, and that's where Pauline went. It's one of those places that if I could go back, I'd love to just sit and watch, because the stories about Stag Lane as just this social whirl of an airfield are fantastic. And you paint a really vivid picture of it as well. What happens when Pauline is, yeah, pounced upon enough unsuspecting students with her violin to actually get involved there?
Well, she knew that she wanted to learn to fly, and she found Stag Lane, North London. And it was, like you say, a very famous place. It launched many a career and many a plane. And of course, she met two people that were, one in particular, that was really to change her life. She met Dorothy Spicer and she met Amy Johnson. Both, the three of them were sort of reaching the heights of what they were going to do. Very young, at a very young age. They were going to break records. They were going to achieve all these licenses between them. And Amy Johnson was going to go from sort of whole typist pool to flying to Australia solo. We need a brilliant idea. Everyone's career path. So they met there and they became great friends. There might have been some sort of idea that they weren't, you know, competitive, but from everything I read, they were very good friends and very supportive of each other. And Pauline and Dorothy in particular, they decided very early on, in sort of early way of, you know, good working relations, they decided that one was going to concentrate on being a pilot, and Dorothy would, you know, hone her skills and her very natural talent as an engineer. So they focused on their talents. They didn't overlap, so they weren't competing with each other. And together they set up, as I'll come on to later, and they were a formidable team together.
Yeah, Dorothy Spicer seems as remarkable a lady as Pauline at the same time, isn't it? She's the mechanic who is always there, always pushing, getting all of her chits as well, which must have, as you can, must have made the gentleman she was going through those courses with very raised an eyebrow, perhaps. But what sort of flying were they getting up to? Because it was not uneventful, if one is to use it.
Not at all, no. And their memoir, which they wrote together, goes into great detail about all the many near misses. I mean, I think it was a lot of chance and circumstance, their career to start with. You know, wing and a prayer, literally. But Dorothy was very skilled, and Pauline trusted her that she would keep their plane flying. So every night and all those sort of the summers they spent together, the air circuses, you know, Dorothy would be hard at work checking the plane every night to make sure it was safe. And Pauline would be flinging her logbooks and preparing for the day ahead. But they made such a good team, I think, because they were both, I think, ambitious without sort of sensing they were being ambitious. But they were really making strides. I mean, Dorothy broke down barriers and made huge strides for women in the field of, you know, aeronautical engineering. And Pauline did the same, and she was a pioneering pilot. So together, I think they did break down barriers, and they were in the press, and there was a lot of profile, and all eyes were upon them, really, at that time.
What were the circuses that they flew in? Because it's one of those things that you sort of hear about, Cobham's Flying Circus and things like that. And, of course, Monty Python ripped off the name many years later for a very different thing. But what were these circuses that Pauline and Dorothy got involved in?
Well, I think this was the fun part of the research. You know, these are circuses that the golden era of aviation, the 1930s, you know, a time that will never come again because we've got far too many health and safety rules for it to happen, for a start. And we've, you know, so many different advances in aviation and everything else. So that particular time, you know, not so far after the first flights, and sort of some amazing stunts. And, you know, I read about people being pretending to be human planes in their exhibitions and sort of their sort of, you know, exploits in the sky, really. So they joined Campbell Black's Air Circus. They spent a season with the Crimson Fleet and another season with the British Hospitals Pageant, which involved, you know, one summer or 2 months out of the year, they might fly across England 200 towns to give displays. These were long hours, long days. And as I said, that, you know, they would be looking after the plane at night. But I imagine they had huge amounts of fun doing this. You know, they were young. They were like daredevils in a way, and they were just having fun. And they were two women, usually in a crowd of men. I've seen photos, and photos in the book, the Barnstormers, and there's a group of men really, and there's Pauline and Dorothy looking like they're having as much fun as the whole group, really. There were never too many accounts of huge amounts of sexism. I think obviously they were doing something different. They were very much in a man's world, but they were proving themselves in that man's world, I think. So I think they were just wasn't overtly any too bad in that way.
I was doing a bit of Googling earlier, and I realized I forgot one important question when I saw a picture of Pauline and Dorothy and their dog.
Ah, yes.
Because it was very much the third one in this group. Where did the dog come from?
Very, very well spotted. Well, I think Pauline had the same love of animals as her father. And she, this always seemed to be a little dog in the photographs that I, when I was looking. So Wendy was the dog that she had for a few years, and she flew 5,000 miles with him, if you can imagine that. And I think she's a little Yorkshire Terrier, I think, and her hair must have been quite blown by, you know, the open cockpits. But, you know, she was in lots of, fair amount of flights. So, yes, and I think she flew around the country with them.
Wendy's a good name. So besides the circuses, they're honing a very early sort of form of air taxi business. And how did they get on? Because it's very unusual for it to be a woman-led company, let alone a woman-led early airline.
Completely. I mean, they were unique. This was another first in their lives between them. They set up Air Trips Limited. And they had advertising and sort of they just decided they were going to set up in a field. That was the first, one of the first summers. And I think they had a sign saying flights turn left here. You know, it was very basic. They sat in this field and waited, and eventually word got around that you could go up for a few shillings or the actual price. And, you know, these women would take you up. And then a couple of summers were in Norfolk, in Hunstanton. Probably their happiest summers, I think. They called it Happy Hunstanton. And I was going to come to this point at the end of our chat, but I was lucky enough last year to meet somebody who'd been up with them.
Oh, wow.
So he's in his mid-90s, and they inspired him to join the RAF and become a pilot. So as soon as this is all connections through the RAF news, they'd done a preview of the book, and he, you know, it sparked memories. And so I was, you know, I thought I'm not going to meet many people that have met Pauline and Dorothy. So I went to visit him in Norfolk, and it was a lovely afternoon with all his memories and bits of Spitfire all around his house and lots of memorabilia. And I think, you know, he enjoyed our afternoon in the meeting. I gave him signed copies of the book. But, oh, he said, yes, these two young girls just turn up in a field, and we knew they were coming, and we used to run off to the fields and be taken up with them. And, yeah, they just took up 33,000 passengers over those summers. Usually sometimes just for a short hop, you know, 5 minutes up in the air. Again, this is all the time, isn't it? That wouldn't happen now. There'd be far too much charting of the airways. But, yeah, they did that.
We must remember that it's an entirely different environment. You know, for us, it's holiday, isn't it? You go to the airport, you get squidged onto an aluminium tube and... Yeah. People try to make as much money out of you as possible, and that's it. But to go up in an aeroplane in the 1930s was just the most remarkable opportunity for anyone. And it's, you know, you said that the chap that you spoke to said these ladies showed up and off they went. And it's a familiar story for people with their first flights. It was usually a chance encounter where somebody was able to seize an opportunity or blag their way into the good graces of the pilot.
Indeed, and there are lots of I put lots of details of those flights in the book. One particular one was that Pauline found lots of she'd taken up clearly someone a Catholic because they'd left lots of little relics around the plane afterwards and a rosary, probably because they were hoped they'd get down in one piece. So they'd left all these. And she just thought that was really funny having to collect all this at the end of her flight. So she was, I mean, I think she used her writer's eye to put all that detail into her book. And I think that she just thought that was hugely, sense of fun in there as well, that she was giving these people experiences, but she was getting some interesting human interactions along the way.
We're going to talk about her writing in a second, but I suppose we have to ask the question, what did her father make of all of this? As, you know, a stern, like, sort of the Edwardian age, you know, his daughter running an airline, gallivanting off around the country. What did the MP think of his daughter's actions?
Well, I think it showed in Pauline's character that she was very good at diplomacy and slowly and quietly getting her own way, because that's what she did. And also you mentioned earlier him being proud is what you do with daughters. You know, he was proud of her. So obviously he put up a front to start with, and, you know, wasn't going to help her. But then by her 21st birthday, he bought her a plane, a second-hand Spartan. I think his reasoning was probably that, you know, he'd rather she was doing it safely with sort of a decent plane. I think he knew that probably that she was probably had the strength of character that he did and went for a cause. And I think he knew that she was going to become a pilot or whatever. So he might as well support her. And then it wasn't so long, I think, before he was really proud of her, and all the cuttings in his scrapbook showed that pride.
For sure. As the father of the daughter, I still have boxes of artwork and school reports and pictures and things. You keep these.
Keep everything, yeah.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Director of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we're at the Pima Air and Space Museum with our Douglas A-20G Havoc. A-20 Havoc was an attack aircraft light bomber of World War II. Originally built and designed with a glass nose with a bombardier. In the Pacific Theater, like B-25s, Pappy Gunn came up with this idea of manning these aircraft with solid noses and a bunch of machine guns for doing strafing attacks on Japanese airfields and attacking Japanese shipping. This aircraft is an actual combat veteran. It flew with the 89th Bomb Squadron in New Guinea on a mission. I think bombing WEWAC, it was damaged and made an emergency landing in a swamp in New Guinea. The crew was recovered and the aircraft sat there pretty much forever until it was found in the 80s. And in the early 90s, it was recovered by the Royal Australian Air Force. This A-20 with another one that they had, they restored the one Helen Pelican, which was another combat veteran from the Pacific. They used a lot of the parts from this aircraft with that aircraft. Then actually went to a civilian owner, and then we ended up buying from that civilian owner and finished up the restoration, put it on display here. It's a unique aircraft in the fact there's only about four, if I recall, A-20 Havocs anywhere on display in the world, with one in a private collection, one at the Air Force Museum, one here, and one in a private collection in Russia. But I'd say it's always been one of my favorite aircraft, I think just because of the lack of them as survivors, and also just seeing a lot of those cool photos from World War II where you see these A-20s coming in low over a ball, bombing Japanese cruisers and transports. And, you know, they're like literally flying right like at mass height over these ships. So I just always found it to be a pretty cool airplane.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Like we were saying before, it was the Pauline is a sort of artist as writer, which I knew nothing about and was enthralled to hear about, you know, Piffling Poems for Pilots and her book and things. What were the reactions to the collections? Because you sort of include a few in your book along with your own poetry. That's I sort of love that you sort of have that connection there. But what was the reaction when this daughter of an MP who was gallivanting around the country in an airplane published a collection of poems?
I think it was a fairly amused reaction, possibly, but mostly they were very well received. She'd made her name for herself already, and then to have this added interest that she was writing poems, and, you know, it was detailed that she was writing them while waiting to take up passengers. And once she wrote an overly long poem, and Dorothy, who probably wasn't so much into poetry, said, I really quite like it. If you stop that poem now, I think, you know, if we end at line six, that would be great. So, you know, there's a little backstory that where she was composing her poems. I tried to follow her suit, actually, and try and write a poem while I was being taken up in a small plane. And as soon as I realised that, you know, I was going to be airsick and couldn't even write anything, I decided. But, you know, I admire her for doing that in between all that sort of frantic sort of flying life that she had. So yes, they were well received. And Amy Johnson said very good things about it. She offered a review of her envied friend's achievements, saying that although the exhilaration of flying often made her want to break into song, she didn't have Pauline's talent with the written word. And she reminded readers of the Tunbridge Wells advertiser that her friend enjoyed a successful strategic partnership. Pauline flies and composes poems, while Dorothy looks after the engine in the machine. I think she's putting that very succinctly of how that partnership works.
Looking back at it over the course of 80 years and with a poet's eye, and there's someone with a tin ear for these sorts of things, do they hold up? I don't know if that's the right question to ask, but yeah, for someone who looks at these things probably a little bit more critically than say I would, and just think, oh, that's lovely, and turn the page, the sort of way she would compose and phrase, what's your poet's sensibilities say about them?
It's a really interesting question. And when I knew that she wrote poetry, when I managed to get hold of Piffling Poems for Pilots, I was a little bit wary. I thought, what am I going to think of them? You know, because like you say, there's this 80-year gap and poetry is so much different now, and how we perceive it, how we write it, how we, you know, read it aloud. So I think they stand the test of time. They're very much of their time, the way they're written. Some people might say that they're almost light verse. And I don't think Pauline herself took them extremely seriously. I think she thought she was writing to entertain, really. So they're very accessible. And they have that important sense of humour that I think marks her life and her career. So they're full of humour. And I've also discovered there's a depth to them. There's a flickering subtlety of light and shade, but mostly there's humour.
Yes, the few you have in the book, I don't know, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Did you have a favourite you wanted to share? Or?
Well, I mean, there's one I did put in the chapter about her poems, so I could share that one.
And that would be lovely. Like I said, you know, it might be wasted on me, but I'm sure our listener is far more discerning person than I am when it comes.
Well, I think this really shows her sense of humour. Mm. So it's called The Stranger Pilot. From some far continent he came to teach us how to fly. We'd not even heard his name, from whence he came or why. He told us of all the things he'd done at least 100 times, and all about the cups he'd won in distant foreign climes. From tales he told we had to grant, he was no also-ran. With wonder we exclaimed, "You can't." But he replied, "I can." It was a joy to tease and bait that pilot of renown, and each in turn would lie in wait and try to do him down. One day we caught him by the sea, that was the last of him. Demortuous, well, R.I.P., the blighter couldn't swim.
she's clearly having a lot of fun.
She is.
With her observations.
I think it was that. It was a sense of fun and a little bit of getting at the pilot that obviously thought he was a wizard pilot, to use another term from the time.
You clearly spent a lot of time with her work and things. How did it inspire you in your own works when you were writing about the women and what sort of moved you after spending a lot of time with Pauline's poetry?
I think possibly that she didn't go on to write more, really. Mm. They were sort of poems of a young woman. As I said, they were amusing, they're light. But I've only really just thought this, but she might have gone on to write some deeper poems. She might have gone on to write all sorts of things. But I think they're of their time, but they're of her time as well. Mm. Yeah. And it was also, just to add, it was quite an honour to republish them and to have the permission of her son to put them in this book as well, because I think it's just giving them that extra lease of life, really.
Very much so. And it's remembering just how young she was throughout all the things that she crammed in. But the other thing you mentioned earlier was her sort of memoir of her and Dorothy's adventures, Women with Wings. How did that book differ from the poetry? Because that's very much more a sort of nuts and bolts, what we're getting up to sort of thing.
It really is, yeah. And I was delighted. It's a very rare book now. I was really delighted to get my hands on a copy because until I read that book, I really didn't have Pauline's voice, I don't think. Mm. I tried to find a copy online and I was very pleased when a researcher who's now become a friend lent me a copy and she bubble wrapped it beautifully. I was thinking this book is, I think it might have been between lockdowns and it was coming at Christmas time when I remember the post had all stacked up. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I opened my door and it was on the doorstep. And, you know, when I unwrapped this bubble wrap and this time and this sort of history, her voice really shines through. So it was a memoir of their time flying together, their 6 summers. And it's the only time that Pauline and Dorothy actually nearly fell out because they couldn't decide who was going to write the main part of the book and who was going to top it, tail it with a forward and afterward. And I'm going to ask you now, Matt, who do you think won?
I'm guessing it was Pauline.
Yeah, she did. Mm. She decided that, yes, a determination won that one. But they didn't fall out for long because Pauline did get to write the main part and Dorothy Spicer did sort of write the introduction and the afterword. But she writes with lots of energy. She's very humorous. And it details their time together, their scrapes and their adventures. But it also includes some of her writings from journals. She wrote for the Women's Engineering Society and lots of other aviation journals. And she was encouraging, really, women to fly and young girls to consider careers in the aviation, bearing in mind it was still in the early times of women actually getting into aviation. So she was a huge advocate for women in that way. And so the book's informative, but it's also very entertaining. And if I could just read a short passage. She almost looked ahead to her own place in aviation history. And this sort of rather poignant but very Pauline paragraph. In 20 or 30 years' time, I can picture myself being looked upon in very much the same light as one now regards the retired captain of a windjammer. I shall be invited to aeronautical dinners as a sort of curiosity. Young pilots employed in making rocket-like ascents from Hyde Park with some up-to-date contraption, which can transport 100 businessmen to Paris in half an hour, will listen and laugh as I make my little speech about the good old days at Stag Lane and Croydon.
To be able to get to Paris in a half an hour.
Exactly.
that's very moving. And because she didn't get that opportunity,
exactly.
And it would have been amazing to have seen her hold court as she undoubtedly would have had she had that opportunity. The thing that really surprised me about this book, you mentioned that Amy Johnson wrote the foreword, and you cover in the book that lots of people have tried to make it out as a rivalry, but it was a friendship, which is clearly from the foreword. But the, how should we put this, prickly editor of Aeroplane.
Ah, yes.
C.G. Gray actually wrote a good review. I believe this is the only time I've ever heard of Gray writing a positive review of something.
He did. I mean, I put some of his less favourable comments in the book as well, which readers can discover. But he did. He wrote that Pauline's keen sense of humour cuts across all her 18 bursts of facile rhyme. The meter runs as almost as evenly as an aero engine, and the authoress is to be recommended for avoiding the highbrow. He goes on to say that the booklet was dedicated to a friend and partner, Miss Dorothy Spicer, which will appeal to all who knew this irrepressible pair of sportsmen. An interesting slant, and one that would probably have caused Pauline to arch at least one eyebrow. But he said good things, so that was all good.
He's a fascinating and terrible character all in the same go. But that is lovely that he was able to recognize that as well. Well, as the world starts getting a little bit darker in the 30s, how are Pauline and Dorothy going? Does the air trips business manage to keep going all the way up till 1939?
No, they finished sooner than that. They both had a, I haven't got the actual date to hand, but they finished a couple of sadnesses in both their lives, and they decided that it was time to wind it up. They'd had their day, and I think the last but one season had been really taking its toll on Pauline's health, and just generally the sort of, you know, it was, they were tiring seasons and summers, and not particularly, didn't make an awful lot of money. So I think they decided that, the 6 years had been long enough, and it was time to do something else. And of course, then war was looming.
So, yeah. We're not going to delve into the formation of the ATA and too much, because we want people to read the book. But I think the question to ask really was, she was very aware of the political situation. I guess being the daughter of an MP, you keep a finger on the pulse, don't you? How did she just use her connections to ensure that the door would eventually open for the women's section? Because she networked like a pro, didn't she?
She did, yes. And she did it in her own style, which someone has said is stealthily, or sort of step by step. And she knew where she was going. She knew that the end result was that she knew there was a pool of, you know, talented women pilots that could be needed and could be used. The ATA was sort of in early ideas, and it was obviously going to be, they hadn't really considered using female pilots. It was going to be men. But Pauline knew that, you know, these women could be utilised and could really help. And so once, you know, discussion started, and she did use the sort of networking that she'd, you know, the connections she'd made. So she sort of almost one meeting at a time, just pushing slowly, slowly, but she got where she wanted. And she used that skill of diplomacy and sort of leadership in her role throughout the sort of time as she was leading, because then she, you know, she won equal pay for her women, which after all the many firsts is something that perhaps people do not know about her. And it was the first in employment history, you know, that women achieved equal pay for doing the same job.
Which is something the WASPs over in the States never got, was it? I think.
I don't think so.
Having
no.
just, yeah. yeah. That's, it's, yeah. that is, it's a remarkable thing, because the danger level's exactly the same exactly. in that role. So there can't really be too much argument about it. Well, just turn to legacy now. And what do you think Pauline's legacy is today? You know, like we were saying before, that the ATA shines bright as this incredible moment, but having spent so much time with her, what do you feel her legacy is or should be?
I think she deserves to be much better well known, which was one of the reasons for wanting to write this new biography. She was a clear leader of her time. Lots of the women who I interviewed or read, sort of their own recollections of her, said she was a natural leader. And they all sort of recount this with warmth, and they really remember her as a good, solid leader, but who was kind and compassionate as well, and empathy, which all those sort of leadership qualities. So I think that was a legacy. I think the fact that she led those women successfully through the war, 1 in 10 of all the ATA pilots died. 1 in 10, yes, it was. And so she had to deal with all those sort of situations as well, and just keep on leading. So I think her resilience and her sort of all those qualities she showed was a huge legacy. But the fact that, you know, she enabled those women to fly in all the planes and had all the experiences, which in turn then enabled them to, some of them at least, to be able to fly after the war, which in turn led some of those ATA women pilots to set up the British Women Pilots Association 10 years after the war. So you can see her legacy feeding down the decades, and the fact that, you know, some of the ATA women set up this association, which is still going strong, and which I really wanted to bring this book up to date with and share some interviews and some of those highlights, and just to show her legacy in that way. So
I'm a fan. It is a wonderful, wonderful book, and the humanity that you capture there is as well is wonderful. And I guess legacy wise, what a change that around to a more personal question. What does she mean to you now?
Well, I had her portrait. Her and Dorothy sat for portraits, or photographs actually, and they were in the National Portrait Gallery. And so I bought those at the start of the process, and she was sort of above my desk as I wrote, and there's this clear gaze of hers. So I think what she means is, as a woman of a time of who made her time very much important to herself, but also a much bigger picture, and her role and her war effort and her sort of what she did for other women, really, I think. And I think that's her legacy, and I think that's the connection I felt with her when I was writing about her. And the fact that tragically her life was cut short, you know, after giving birth to twins. And, you know, that's when I read that, and when I discovered that, I thought, wow, that's it's a sadness. It's a huge sadness. But if we can bring her more into the public mind and memory, I think that's important too.
And I think you've done that very well. I do have one extra thing with you. What is your favorite Pauline Gower moment that people should hunt for in the book?
That's a question I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I see. I don't always throw one in to catch out my guests.
Favorite. I think people should look for a story about a swamp. And also, it's a little tie in there, because in the RAF Museum, where they have a wonderful archive, which I was only able to access almost towards the end of the writing process, because I was writing in lockdown and these places were closed. So I went and had a lovely day in the archive and found some of her own writing. And she wrote a short story about the swamp episode, Death in the Swamp. So if people could read that as well alongside, I think that would just be the brilliant sort of Pauline Gower moment. But there were many.
Fantastic. Alison, this has been a delight. I thoroughly enjoyed the book. So thank you so much for spending the time with us and writing the book. Because I devoured it. It was just a wonderful, wonderful read.
Thank you very much for letting me share her story. And hopefully people will be able to find out more about Pauline as well. So thank you.
Thank you. I cannot thank Alison Hill enough for joining us here on The Damcasters. I found her book really quite touching and moving, as there were so many aspects of Pauline's life I had no clue about. Her life working with Dorothy Spicer before the war was something that shone a light on an era of British flying that I find utterly fascinating, in that you could just go find some random people in a field with an airplane and go for a flight. How cool would that have been? But Pauline's book, which is out now from the History Press, is called Pauline Gower, Pioneering Leader of the Spitfire Women. And as I said, I thoroughly enjoyed it and I can highly recommend it. It is a fascinating read and Alison has done a wonderful job with the biography. I just have to thank the History Press for sending me a review copy and putting me in touch with Alison as well. It's very kind of them. As always, there'll be a link to the book from our bookshop in the description below. As usual, a little bit goes to support the podcast. And of course, the best way you can support the podcast is by liking, subscribing, doing all those sorts of things. But just give us a quick review. Whatever your podcast app of choice is, stick some stars in it, leave some notes, let me know how we're getting on, if there's anything you'd like to see. And it really does help nudging the algorithms into helping people find the podcast. Of course, you can always tell your friends, because, you know, that's the easy way to get people to listen. Just tell them how great this is, despite the guy that hosts it. The guests are fantastic. And we have more fantastic guests coming up. I'd just like to take this moment as well to thank our sponsor and partner, the Pima Air and Space Museum. We're going to be having another fantastic interview with one of the people from Arizona at the beginning of May. So keep your ears peeled for that one. Of course, there's the Patreon as well, £3 a month. We're going to call it the Damcasteers going on forward, mainly because I'm really excited about the upcoming Musketeers movie and being a Dumas nut. Why not? So if you want to join and become a Damcasteer, check out the links in the description below. There's going to be more bits and pieces on there. We've got a new video up where I delve into my love-hate relationship with the First of the Few. That's for the Patreon fans for the time being. And I think it was a lot of fun to do. Next time, we'll have another guest. And as always, we'll be back soon next week with another episode. And I do hope you'll join us. Until then, thank you, everybody, for your continued support of the pod. This is great fun. I know it's been a couple of weeks since the last episode.
bit of the black dog, but thanks for understanding and tuning in again. So until next time, thank you so much for listening and do take care of yourselves. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone, and it is a Boney Abroad's podcast production. To check out our other podcasts, head to boneyabroad.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.